Legendary comedic actress Cloris Leachman passed away at the end of January. We'll pay tribute on this episode of Pop Life. Welcome to WAER's pop culture podcast, Pop Life. I'm Joe Lee. We have quite a bit of ground to cover on this episode, including the entertainment outlook for 2021, with HBO Max at the center of our conversation. But first, with a career spanning more than 70 decades, the late Cloris Leachman left an enviable legacy of work behind that garnered 8 Primetime Emmy Awards and a coveted Academy Film Award. From the Mary Tyler Moore Show to her appearance in 3 Mel Brooks movies, Cloris Leachman had impeccable comedic timing. Joining us to discuss her legacy and more is media historian Bob Thompson, director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University. Welcome back to the show, the OG, the original gangsta guest of Pop Life, Bob Thompson. How's it going, Bob?
Very well. How about with you?
I'm good. So, sad news. You and I like to get together from time to time to talk about some of the folks in popular culture, television, movies that have passed on so that we can, take a look at the legacy of work that they leave behind and introduce folks that may not be familiar with them to some of the great work that a lot of these legendary folks have produced. So recently we saw the passing of veteran actor Cloris Leachman. She passed away at the age of 94, and we know her best for her role as Phyllis on the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And for folks that are listening that are of a younger age that don't know that show, it was a groundbreaking show, and Cloris Leachman played Mary Tyler Moore's landlord. And then that spun off into her own show called Phyllis. Before we jump into Cloris Leachman, Bob, give us a little background on the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Yeah, well, CBS debuts this in 1970, September of 1970. And this is a period when, and we've talked about this before, when so much of television was flying nuns and talking horses and witches and my mother the car and all of that kind of thing. And we had a little bit of the independent wit woman in a show called That Girl that was playing during that period. Marlo Thomas starred in that.
Loved that show.
She was an independent woman. She wanted to be an actress. She'd gone to New York and she wanted to make it on her own. But she didn't have to make it on her own because she had not one but 2 men that constantly she fell back on. One was her father, whom she actually called Daddy on the show. Mm-hmm. And the other was her fiancé, Don Hollinger. So while that show was really kind of trying to reflect the real world changes in gender identity and women and all that kind of thing, it never quite got there. So Mary Tyler Moore is coming off of the Dick Van Dyke Show, which was a beloved show, and she was a beloved character. And CBS is dying to get her on a show of her own. So she and her producer and the 2 writers that made the show come up with an idea that she's going to be a recently divorced woman in her 30s, which would have been a big deal, who now has to go out and get a job and make it after all. And they got a memo back from CBS, a legendary memo that said, there's 4 types of people that the American public will not accept in a comedy. People from New York, people with mustaches, Jews, no kidding, they said that, and people that are divorced. So MTM, the company, actually backed off and made her not divorced. She had broken up after a long relationship and made her way to Minneapolis. To show how influential that show was, within a couple of years, the spinoff of her best friend Rhoda, starring mm-hmm. Valerie Harper, a show called Rhoda. Rhoda was divorced. She was Jewish. She lived in New York, where the show was set. I'm not sure she was particularly her suit. I don't think she had a mustache.
Yeah.
But 3 out of 4 are not bad. And those taboos were all broken thanks to the likes of the Mary Tyler Moore Show and 2 of its other CBS sisters that came out that year and the year after, All in the Family in 71 and MASH in 72.
And then the talented Cloris Leachman, well, she came into the American public eye as a Miss America contestant back in 1946. Some of our younger listeners may remember her as the grandmother in Malcolm in the Middle, but that role in Mary Tyler Moore was, I think, you know, essential for launching, really launching her into popular American culture. Talk about that role on the Mary Tyler Moore Show and its spinoff into Phyllis.
Yeah, and it's a real, I think, testament to what a star Cloris Leachman was, in that we've been talking now for, what, 6-7 minutes, and we haven't even gotten around to the fact that, oh, yeah, and she also won an Oscar.
Yeah.
I mean, it's that's kind of a footnote in her career. So in the Mary Tyler Moore Show, she plays not even the second banana. That went to Rhoda. Mm-hmm. She plays a third banana, this kind of minor character of Mary's landlord. And she was the best third banana, I think, in all of American comedy. She turned out to be the relationship she had. Rhoda and Mary, of course, were best friends. Phyllis was always so envious of that. She really loved Mary. She wanted to be Mary's soulmate and all of that. And the way that worked out and played out, and what Cloris Leachman could do with one withering look at Rhoda was just extraordinary. There were four really remarkable female characters in that show. Mary, of course, Rhoda, Phyllis, and Sue Ann Niven. And Sue Ann Niven, who was the oldest of the batch, played by Betty White, is now the only one that still survived. There was a scene, though, in the final episode of the Mary Tyler Moore Show. So by this time, Phyllis had already spun off into her own show, as Rhoda had done, but they bring them all back for the final episode. And there's one single scene in that final episode where they're in Mary's apartment and they're going through the usual ballet of Phyllis's jealousy of Rhoda. And I swear you could watch that scene with the sound down and give her an Emmy just for the expressions on her face.
You can spend some time. I mean, I'll have plenty of time. I don't have a job as of Monday.
Oh, we know. Lou told us when he called. Yeah, it's obviously a case of sexual discrimination.
Oh, no, no, Phil. They fired the guys, too.
Oh, Mary, you little goose. It was just to cover their tracks.
But we should remember, even though she got 8 Emmy Awards, which ties Julia Louis-Dreyfus for the biggest number by one individual, and actually Cloris Leachman got another one for a daytime Emmy. But even though she got 8 Emmy Awards, only 2 of those were for playing Phyllis. Mm-hmm. 2 of them were for Malcolm in the Middle, which you just mentioned, and 4 others were for other things.
Yeah, and she also won, I think, a small handful of Golden Globe Awards as well. Very talented actress. Like I said, she's known mostly for her comedic work, but as you mentioned, she did win an Oscar for more serious work back in
71, I think.
71,
was the Oscar she got for the last picture show, playing the very dissatisfied spouse of the high school football coach.
Right. And you know, back then maybe okay, but for today, boy, that would be risque material. So she was a dissatisfied middle-aged woman who had a brief affair with a high school football player, Bob. That would be frowned upon today.
Yeah, I mean, that would be we'd make an entire HBO Max series about it now. And certainly there are podcasts about similar relationships. But yeah, that was a pretty big deal. Now, of course, that was a movie. By 1971, movies had moved on to more material than television was able to. But 1971, of course, is the when that movie was released, Mary Tyler Moore Show had already started. And of course, All in the Family came out in 71 as well. So things were changing. It is, I suppose, you go back and look at that. She is a spectacular dramatic actor. She's mm-hmm. on Broadway and in other movies as well. I guess it's just that when you've got someone who is a spectacular dramatic actor, but a mind-bogglingly great comic, you tend to put them in comic roles, and we mostly remember her in those. We still haven't mentioned the three Mel Brooks movies that she was.
We're definitely going to talk about that. That movie was called The Last Picture Show. She also starred or had a role in another dramatic project called Kiss Me Deadly, which was a detective movie based on a Mickey Spillane novel. But yeah, we get to the comic stuff, and the Mel Brooks stuff is where I know her best for. Now, I will always remember her as Frau Blücher, the Transylvanian housekeeper whose name scared the bejesus out of horses whenever it was mentioned. That is what, if anyone ever just says Cloris Leachman, that's who will pop into my head. It's Frau Blücher.
I am Frau Blücher.
Steady!
How do you do? I am Dr. Frankenstein. This is my assistant, Inga. May I present Frau Blücher? I wonder what's got into them.
Your rooms have been prepared, Herr Doctor. If you will follow me.
Igor, would you bring the bags as soon as you're finished, please?
Yes, Master.
After you, Frau Blücher.
Yeah, and I am so glad that Mel Brooks and Cloris Leachman found each other, because you could argue that she was born to be in Mel Brooks movie. She only did three, they were three real doozies.
Yeah, that one was the Young Frankenstein. She also went on to do High Anxiety back in 1977 and History of the World Part One in 1981. Hilarious stuff, and you know, I guess it'd be kind of hard to be terrible in a Mel Brooks movie because the writing is so clever and funny, but she just brought those characters to life. So we say goodbye to Cloris Leachman, who passed away again January of 2021. But Bob, I wanted to have you on to look forward in 2021. In terms of how we're going to be getting a good bit of our content, I'm looking at, you know, what's happened with the movie industry because of COVID. I'm considering what that industry might be going forward. In my opinion, and based on my own preferences, I'm not sure, even with a vaccine and people becoming more comfortable being out and about, that I'm going to be ready to be in a crowded movie theater anytime soon. And so we see this shift in proliferation in online streaming. One of the things that's big for 2021, it started at the end of, or really in December of 20, was Warner Media's decision to release simultaneously all of its 2021 slate of movies, both in theater and on their streaming platform on HBO Max. Do you see that as a major shift in what might happen with the movie industry?
Well, I think that announcement by Warner Brothers was a major moment, was a kind of symbolic point. But I think it represented something that has been going on for a long time. And like a lot of other things, COVID has just accelerated the evolution of developments that were happening in education, in entertainment, all over the place. First of all, one could argue that the movies, the traditional movie, going out, going to a theater with other people in a dark room and looking at a big giant picture sprawled out all over the wall of a building, has been assaulted by new technologies many times before. The first real assault on the movies was television. Way back in the late 40s and certainly the 50s, by the time people started getting TVs. And to an extent, we have never gotten back to the average person's average number of movies they went to per week. We've never gotten to that rate since television really kicked in. But movies figured out ways to deal with that. Ticket prices went up, and movies survived just fine through the era of television. The next thing that potentially changed things was the VCR. You know, it used to be if you wanted to see a movie, you had to go and see it at a theater. Or you could wait for, quite a while for it to play in a rerun, on network television, Saturday Night at the Movies and all that kind of thing. But then if you missed that, you couldn't see it. The VCR meant that you could now go down to your mom and pop video store or later the Blockbuster and get a movie off a shelf like you'd go to the library. You could, in fact, go to the library and program movies, watch at home. So all of that started developing. Then, of course, even before that, we had places like HBO and Showtime, which got you movies. So people had gotten used to watching movies in their living rooms on their TV sets.
Right. And then comes after VCRs, Blu-ray. And with that, the ever-increasing size of televisions. And I remember back then where the movie industry was taking a serious decline in revenue. And the way that they decided to fight that was to really, really go after big blockbuster, high production movies with eardrum shattering sound and big images on the screen to fight and position themselves against the small screen. Basically, you remember when the movie would start, you know, it would be big image on the screen, and it would slowly shrink to something the size of your computer. And basically say that you can't really enjoy this kind of action on a small screen. That was the way that they tried to position themselves against the revolution of small screen home entertainment. And I think that was effective for a minute. But what happened, in my opinion, was they went away from sort of the thinking man and woman's pictures, you know, produced by folks like Focus Features. And really just started getting into the comic book movies, the big blockbuster, big production movies. And so they became sort of one-dimensional to me. And now you have all of this content that's not only coming at you through streaming services, but the televisions keep getting bigger. The resolution keeps getting better. You have sound bars and surround sound systems that just bring that experience into your home now. Couple that with a global pandemic and fears of going out and into crowded spaces. And I think we're back at a place where the movie industry is going to struggle, you know, and I think people like Christopher Nolan, who has come out big against Warner Media's decision, are very nervous about getting same day release movies on streaming services. Let's take a look at some of what we'll get. Now, personally, I am thrilled with what HBO Max is going to do. I don't know how they're going to make the kind of money they made with only theater releases, because I'm already a HBO subscriber. So I get these releases, you know, as a part of my subscription. So they're not getting new money out of me. But let's take a look at some of the things that'll be coming out. Just this week alone, there will be Little Things with Denzel Washington. He's a detective embroiled in a search for a serial killer. Going to have Rami Malek and Jared Leto in it. One I'm really looking forward to is Judas and the Black Messiah. It's a true story chronicling Black Panther leader Fred Hampton. It's going to have our guy Lakeith Stanfield from Atlanta in it, and Daniel Kaluuya from Black Panther. This is the story of Black Panther leader, but not the Black Panther from the Marvel comics. So it's interesting that we have both of those elements in there. Tom and Jerry, the cartoon of our childhood, Bob. You'll have Godzilla versus King Kong. You'll have Space Jam, which is a new legacy featuring LeBron James. Two really anticipated releases that, you know, should be big blockbuster movies seen in the theater, but I'm going to enjoy from the comfort of my own home. That'll be Dune, the redone sci-fi epic
We'll have Timothy Chalamet, Oscar Isaac, and Josh Brolin. That's going to be based on Frank Herbert's novel. It's been done a couple of times. Never has, I think, reached the treatment that it deserves. So I have big expectations and hopes for this. And then the most anticipated return of the Matrix franchise, which will be directed by Lana Wachowski. And that plot and how they're going to bring that back is extremely secretive. So they're keeping the lid tight on that one. So you look at this slate of stuff coming out in 2021 and that you and I can enjoy from the comfort of our own couch, and you have to wonder how and if we'll ever get back in the theater.
Well, I think, and I think you've laid it out beautifully. There were a couple of things, again, that were already happening. And as TV screens, as you pointed out, got bigger and higher definition, the theater industry, in many ways, was getting, the screens were getting smaller. Used mm-hmm. to be you'd go to see, you know, at the, we've got one of them still here in Syracuse in the Landmark Theater. Was at the Lowe's Theater at the time. You'd, big screen experience. As my television during my adult life got bigger and bigger in my living room, the TV screen that I would go to at the Cineplex was getting smaller and smaller as they were chopping those spaces up into smaller and smaller yeah. areas to more efficiently sell tickets. You're also right that just like in the 50s when TV came out, they went with Cinerama and 3D and all of these kinds of things. Movies really went to something that you had to see on the big screen, including 3D. But as you pointed out, it may have been in 3D, but the characters were more one-dimensional. So all of that stuff was going on as it was. And you also pointed out that TV, which because of cable and then streaming, didn't have to worry about swearing and sex and all that kind of stuff anymore. All of a sudden, by the turn of the century, not all of a sudden, gradually by the turn of the century, television was doing all the serious stuff that movies used to be the only ones that could do. The Sopranos and Sex and the City as we as the century turned, and then The Wire and all the things we talk about. So that if you're not into the Marvel Universe, TV was the place you were going to anyway before yeah. COVID.
And one of the things that's happening too is with streaming platforms and these the way that they're telling stories through these series now, it really is like taking a long movie and breaking it up into 10 parts.
Sometimes for the good and sometimes not.
Yeah, sometimes for the good and sometimes not. You're absolutely right. But it's not episodic, or it's not situational anymore. It's more episodic, and really keeps people coming back, and you sort of prolong your enjoyment of that. I wonder if there is, and I'm sure there is, on the part of Warner Media and their strategy here with HBO Max is to really claim its space in the streaming world. You got some big players. You have Netflix, right. You have Disney Plus, you have now HBO Max, and now you have these television networks that are breaking off and doing original programming that is available only on their streaming platforms. I look at like CBS and what they're doing with the Star Trek franchise. So these companies are developing or acquiring these franchises and making them only available in their spaces. So it's requiring us to have all of these different accounts to watch this stuff. And it's interesting to see how it's going to unfold and whether we will continue to accept to be splintered like that in our options. But you look at so Disney Plus has the Marvel Cinematic Universe under their control. And they also have the Star Wars franchise. And so what they're going to be offering under the Marvel Universe is a new Loki series, WandaVision that just launched, and under Star Wars, they have the Book of Boba Fett that'll be coming out. They're already working on season 3 of The Mandalorian, which has been a big hit. So
they've got 10 new Star Wars series and 10 new Marvel series coming yeah. out. Warner Brothers would like to go in that route with Harry Potter, which they've been now talking about that series, and with the Game of Thrones franchise. Will Game of Thrones plus Harry Potter equal Marvel plus Star Wars? Probably not. And they've got a lot of catching up to do. But you're right about all of this. And Warner Brothers, they had two bonuses here. One, they were dying to get HBO Max to play in the same league as Netflix. And because of COVID, they had this opportunity. The studios don't need the theaters. Mm-hmm. There is now technology that will allow the studios to do exactly what they just did in the case of Warner Brothers, take it to streaming and whatever bonus they get in theaters. The theaters, on the other hand, need the studios. They can't sell popcorn if they're not showing good movies. So getting back to what you said in the beginning, I think the relationship between the studios and the theaters and between us and the theaters are going to be changed forever. I don't think movie theaters are going to go away. You need a place to go on a date if you don't live in a big city. There are lots of advantages to it. But I think people are getting so used to the convenience of watching what you want when you watch it. They're getting used to the fact that so many great movies are coming directly to screening, to streaming, even before these deals. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking just recently, The Five Bloods, Mank, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, The Trail of A Trial of the Chicago 7, all four directly to Netflix, all four on AFI's top 10 list of best movies of 2020. Amazon Prime had Sound of Metal and One Night in Miami. I mean, there's so much good stuff on there anyway, and it's kind of like people with stereos. When I was a kid, you paid your rent, you fed yourself, and whatever money was left over, you got a big giant stereo that would blast and vibrate stuff off the tables. And then came the portability of the iPod and all that kind of stuff. And people very quickly learned to live with not having that kind of physical sound environment, but the convenience of being able to listen to whatever they wanted individually, wherever they wanted. And what happened to is there a stereo store in Syracuse anymore? Probably somewhere, but I don't know where. I think going to a theater now is going to become much more a specialized thing, like going to the theater, because we've now trained people for many years before this, but certainly for the last year, to watch this stuff whenever they want it, wherever they want it. And I'm not sure they're going to be all that anxious to get back, even if we weren't worried about sitting in a room and getting infected.
You know, it'll be interesting to hear your thoughts on who the winners are in all of this. Well, I can think of one particular winner, and that is the filmmakers, writers, producers themselves, where you would have these film festivals where movie theater or movie producers, production houses, companies would show up and fight over the sort of handful of top movies that are presented at a film festival. Now you have not only movie theaters there, but you have all these streaming players showing up and bidding on things as well. So if we look at, you know, what's coming out in 2021 for Netflix, what they've acquired a few from movie festivals. You have Concrete Cowboy, which is a movie with Idris Elba. He's an urban cowboy living in Philadelphia. They could pick that up from the Toronto Film Fest. And then one of Netflix's biggest acquisitions in terms of original content is going to be Don't Look Up. It's a comedy with Leonardo DiCaprio, Jennifer Lawrence, Meryl Streep, Kate Blanchett. I mean, that is movie theater, big budget crew right there. And that's being touted as one of the biggest movies ever assembled for Netflix. So the competition is there. The money is there for them to go after these things. And I think positioning them in a way that they're looking stronger than traditional movie producers.
I think that's true. There are so many more places, so much more real estate to put it. And I think another group that benefits are people with enough income to actually collect a series of these subscriptions and pay them every month. Yeah. And that's my biggest worry, is this does become a have or have not, although I guess movies in theaters was like that as well. But you had pointed out stuff that we would have never seen before. My favorite movie that I've seen in all of 2020 was a thing called The 40-Year-Old Virgin. Rada Blank's kind of spoken word. She's a teacher who is a playwright, but she wanted to become a rapper. I love this film. I've watched it a bunch of times. It was released at Sundance in January. Netflix picked it up in October. That is a film back in the age when I was a kid of broadcast networks, I would have never seen in a million years because it would have never gotten made. Mm-hmm. Even in the age of cable, I would have probably not seen that film. It probably would not have made its way to Showtime or HBO. There are so many movies from so many different voices, so many series from so many different voices that I'm able to see now that I would never have seen before. The downside of that, though, is I've got a subscription to HBO Max and to Disney Plus and to Netflix and to Hulu and to Apple Plus and to the Criterion Channel. And therefore, I have the luxury of hearing these other voices. There are a lot of Americans out there who cannot patch together that kind of budget, mm-hmm. who are not going to have the opportunity to hear this glorious multiple voices of all of these people.
Yeah, that is a great point. That's a fantastic point. I have all of the things that you mentioned. I have Amazon as well. I have Hulu as well. I would have to say that the amount that I'm spending on the various streaming platforms are probably equal to the amount I'm also paying for my cable service in addition. So there's going to have to be some cutting of the cords at the Lee House or something, because the entertainment budget is surpassing my grocery bill.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Do I spend more on monthly streaming subscriptions or Grubhub? I'm not sure which. I think they're close.
Well, regardless of what happens with the movie industry in 2021, I think we're going to have a lot of great content to talk about, you and I, as 2021 unfolds. I'm looking forward to getting a lot of these great movie releases through HBO Max.
Yeah, we're really going to need to talk about that Tom and Jerry when it comes.
We got to talk about Tom and Jerry. Man, I mean, that's that is from like nowhere. That is like out of the blue. I mean, that's you and I. I don't know if today's kids are into Tom and Jerry.
Yeah, well, it's not only you and I, it's you and I older siblings.
Yeah. Yeah. So that'll be interesting to see who they're targeting with that. I mean, a little mouse constantly getting the best of the cat and slapping each other with sledgehammers. I don't know if that is today's kid, but we'll see. But a lot of good stuff coming up. I'm looking forward to watching it and getting back with you to talk about a lot of it. But I want to thank you for joining me on this episode of Pop Life, Bob. And what are you looking forward to in 2021?
Oh, there's so much stuff. I guess Nomadland, which I think is coming out in any minute, which is getting all kinds of talk. And I'm not sure how we're going to see some of this stuff comes out on regular streaming, and some of it you've got to do on demand. Mm-hmm. For example, that great documentary MLK FBI. I saw that on Amazon Prime, but I had to pay like $4.99 for it.
Oh wow! Okay.
So I think all of these. Put it this way, I'm going to have seen a lot more of the Oscar nominees this year probably than ever before, because I'm going to be able to have seen them.
Yeah, same here. And we'll have to talk about those. Bob Thompson, thank you for coming on to Pop Life.
Thank you. Can't wait for the next time.
Since recording this show, The Little Things theatrical release has set a pandemic-era milestone by being the R-rated movie with the biggest opening since the start of the pandemic. Its opening weekend grossed about $4.8 million, and while that's not pre-pandemic opening weekend box office revenue, it could be a sign that concerns over WarnerMedia's HBO Max same-day release streaming strategy might be unfounded. We'll see how the rest of the year plays out. Thanks for listening to Pop Life, a product of WAER Syracuse Public Media. Stalk us wherever you get your podcast. Our producer is Kevin Kloss. Thanks to today's guest, Bob Thompson. I'm Joe Lee.